Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. As I mentioned in the first hour, my friend and executive producer Bryant Shanley and I are coming to you live from Acton University 2025, taking place in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at the DeVos Center. And this is an outstanding avenue of the intersection between faith and reason and culture and politics and the arts and literature and any area of consideration of human flourishing. And it's been this amazing heritage that Al was a part of, that he inducted us into, and we have been so blessed and joyous to continue. All of the interviews that you will be hearing today will be me speaking with professors of the courses at Acton University this year. We will start with speaking with Jim and Jennifer Weber. Now, they're not actually professors, but they're attending Acton University, and they are founders of what's known as the Economic Mission, and they founded this program starting off in Haiti. For years, Jim and Jennifer Weber sent aid to schools and to impoverished people in Haiti, but when they went for a visit, they realized that all of their welfare was only consumed for a moment, and it wasn't helping to remediate the poverty problem. And so what they came to realize is what Haiti needed, what poor people truly need, are solutions, structures, avenues, frameworks that will allow them to take ownership and agency of their life and engage in the work of innovation, engage in the work of meaningful work for the sake of creating value and for contributing to the common good of society. And that's what they did. They built a factory that started exporting goods, that created income for that area and frankly revitalized that area. Unfortunately, corrupt government got in the way, so we're going to talk about all of that after this. And we also talk with David Bonson, he's no stranger to this program, about our debt and economic growth. Is it really true that excessive government debt creates inflation, or is the lesson of history that it creates something far, far worse? We need to seriously understand what it means to be taking on this kind of national debt and the debt-to-GDP ratio and how it will affect us and even our future children. And then finally, we speak with Dan Churchwell about how technology serves the common good. Throughout human history, the development of technology and its proliferation greatly expands human horizons. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, June 24th. It's the solemnity of the Nativity of John the Baptist. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. An early intelligence assessment of the U.S. military strikes on Iran reportedly claimed that it did not completely destroy the country's nuclear program and likely set it back only by months. Multiple outlets are reporting about the highly classified document produced by the Defense Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Central Command. The reports say the U.S. believes there was significant damage, but that was mostly due to structures above ground. The White House has slammed the reporting, calling the alleged assessment flat-out wrong. The Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit against the state of Washington over its recent law mandating that priests must violate the seal of confession if child abuse is learned about during the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson signing the bill into law that goes into effect July 27th. The bill makes exemptions for other professionals, such as nurses and therapists, but priests who fail to report abuse learned in confession could face up to a year in jail and a $5,000 fine. Millions in the Midwest and Northeast are once again dealing with dangerous heat. Here's NBC's Emily Ikeda.
It felt like triple-digit temperatures from Texas to New England Monday, including parts of North Jersey, where a pair of outdoor graduation ceremonies landed 16 attendees in the hospital.
A number of temperature records are expected to be broken again, with some places possibly reaching over 100 degrees. Stocks are higher and oil prices are down following the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Iran. The major indexes are each up well over 1%. Meanwhile, oil prices have been down more than 5% after falling more than 7% Monday. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I am joined by Jim Weber, who is the founder of the Economic Project Network and the author of the book, The Economic Mission. And we're talking about his work in trying to mobilize and empower underprivileged and impoverished nations and communities in these nations for the sake of understanding that in subsidiarity, the best way out of poverty is working within the markets to empower people to create jobs and to have jobs and to create value for the common good. Jim, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you very much.
So, Jim, I just want you to share your story with everyone. What is the Economic Mission Network and what are the principles in your book?
Sure. For about 25 or 30 years now, we were sending food to Haiti, and I went on a trip to Haiti. And I saw that I'm basically feeding these people. They're eating, and then the next day they're in need again. Mm-hmm. So frustrated, I said to my wife, I wanted to do something more. This isn't working. She said, "What?" And I didn't know what. So mm-hmm. I just said, "Let's build a factory." And she said, "Well, what would we make?" And I said, "Polo shirts." And I don't know where it came from. When I got back home, I researched it. There's 530 million polo shirts sold in the United States mm-hmm. every year. And it was feasible for me to be a market leader in both quality and price. So we were making polo shirts in a town called Praville, Haiti, which was an isolated town where people were living on less than a dollar a day, mm-hmm. Where there were children starving to death from malnutrition. And it was a pretty ugly place. But once we started, giving people jobs and once it all started coming together, that $8,000 a week I was paying in payroll kept accumulating, and there was a momentum that built. And when my factory was destroyed by the Haitian senator, yeah. Yuri Lassiter, no one was rich, but everyone was at least eating and getting fed. Malnutrition was greatly diminished, and it was just a better place to be.
And so you've raised some crucial concerns that many people probably don't want to think about. And in our post-Christian West, we don't realize that charity isn't about handouts. We give handouts, and that makes us feel good. But the real call here is to create those avenues and systems for our impoverished brothers and sisters to themselves develop structures and rise up.
Correct. Well, when you talk about charity, I think you're talking about Christian charity and Christian love, and that's what put me in motion. There was no charity as far as handouts with this factory, because these people had to deliver the goods. We had to produce a shirt that was coming off the line at $3.65, $3.70. We had to ship it to America in a certain way. We had to put a logo on it, and all these things had to happen or we were going to lose to other worldwide competitors.
Right.
We had contracts with Subway, Aramark. There were very major players. We went out to see Walmart. So it's not like we were in it. We were in it slugging it out with every other manufacturer in the world, and we were winning. Mm-hmm. So that's the beautiful thing, and it's a model that we're going to try and put together. I can't leave. I was prayerfully considering some things, and God basically said, "Well, you're staying in Haiti too, so I'm going to be still doing things in Haiti, but I'm going to also be trying to do some things in Guatemala."
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's the charity is really about the love and loving these people, giving these people a shot, a shot to be great.
Right.
The coolest thing about the coolest thing is if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. These guys were going from just trying to feed themselves right to the top in a week, where they became heroes in town because everyone in town knew that these guys were bringing, they're bringing the success, they're bringing the shirts, and they're making these shirts, and they're bringing the success, and everyone's eating because of them and because of the factory. It was the cornerstone of the economic engine. We were the only business that employed 100 people, but we were also the only business that employed 5 people. there was no opportunity. So it was a great thing.
And that's precisely what we take for granted in the affluence of the West. We have this wondrous heritage of Christendom and Western civilization that has brought about these avenues of flourishing, and so opportunity, the equality of opportunity and access to opportunity, and therefore upper social mobility.
Yeah.
These countries don't have that.
No, they really don't. And it really started, like, you know, I heard it a million times. Oh, Jim, you're teaching a man to fish. Well, no, I was teaching a man to export fish. and it was the exporting of the fish that made it so successful, mm-hmm. because, you know, getting $8,000 a week in just in sales, let alone in profits, to pay these people in Haiti would have been brutally difficult.
Yep.
But, you know, you have the people, the good people, Aramark in Atlanta, Georgia, and Subway, and all the people, like, they were making that happen for us, and they were actually turning the tide in that town.
Right. And so what you're looking at here is also this global reality of diversification of labor, and so you're going to try to replicate that model for other third world nations like Guatemala.
Correct. And what we look for is we look for an isolated community, because I like when payday hits, I want them spending their money locally. So we look for a place that's kind of isolated from town, so they can't go into town, and I want to keep that money bouncing around.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing about that money is, and you know, some people talk about velocity, and economists talk about velocity of money in terms of years. Well, we would do payday, and that money would get spent six times, like, in the weekend.
Yeah.
Or when the first couple paydays, that money was getting spent six times in 2 hours. A kid was buying food, and a guy that sold the food was buying water or medicine, and da-da-da-da-da. And you could literally look out as the factory was operating and see the roof, like, because none of the houses in my town had roofs. So you could literally see roofs being built as a sign of economic growth. It was
right.
Kind of a cool thing.
And therefore, like you mentioned, fiscal velocity. And
yeah, and the velocity of money was off the charts.
Right, because there was so much need.
Yeah.
And again, you're looking at the flourishing of free market principles when
absolutely.
Governed by virtue.
Absolutely. It's you know, Adam Smith talks about, in his book, he talks about, in Wealth of Nations, about how important the actual manufacturing is, as opposed to being an accountant or a lawyer or any of those things, how, like, that actual manufacturing can bolster an economy. And I saw it. I had 104 employees, and we were pulling 7,500 people out of poverty with that, you know, and people were crossing the poverty line, and it was just a good thing.
Right, and that's precisely what builds, quite literally, the common good. It wasn't just that a few people got jobs; the whole society was getting revitalized.
Exactly, and it was psychological as well. Like, they felt like winners.
Yeah,
and that was really, really cool. I enjoyed that. Like, I would like to, on Friday on paydays, I would always stand on the roof and I would watch the economics happen. It was neat.
And so, in rounding off then, as all of our American listeners are listening right now, but also just across the world, most of our listeners are in areas where we're fairly developed.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth creation is ubiquitous. In fact, it's so commonplace we take it for granted. Do you have a word to say, to share, not only about your mission, but also about what can be done in terms of true charity, that means a true act of love, as opposed to just welfare?
Well, anytime you're buying things from Africa or importing things, and I know that's a dirty word in politics today, but these countries where these people are trapped, they can't make money where there's not money. The reason things popped in Provo, Haiti, where my factory was, is because everyone had a dollar in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you can do to put a dollar in their pocket's a great thing.
Yep.
You know, one of the things I like to do, my wife and I, when we go to Mexico, there's always people on the beach hawking items. Well, I always liked on the last day, you know, either buy some things or do some things or whatever, not necessarily because I want them, but because, you know, those people need a leg up, and it puts money in people's pockets. And anything you do to, and I don't like the charity side of it, we just give it away, but anything you can do to put
uplift,
money in people's
yeah.
is an act of love.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in Barbados or some other place, or in Dominican Republic, and there you see poor people, and, you know, you have a chance to help them, and you have a, you know, and I encourage you to do that. But, you know, for me, it's fire up a polo shirt line.
Well, my guest has been Jim Weber, who is the founder of the Economic Mission Project that's aiming to bring about a revitalization in terms of free market policies in impoverished nations and cultures. And he's also the author of The Economic Mission that can be found on Amazon. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, Michelle, in honor of Tony Dickinson. Thank you so much for your support to build the church and bless the nation.
Would you like to send a salute to your parish priest? Say happy anniversary to your parents or spouse? You can have your own day on Ave Maria Radio. Call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, I want to be a day sponsor.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with David Barnson, founder, managing partner, chief investment officer of the Barnson Group, and he's also one of the professors at this year's Acton University Conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan, 2025. And this year, one of his lectures is Debt, Crowding Out, and Economic Growth. David, always a joy to connect with you. Even when we're in the studios, I always enjoy when I get to connect with you, but to see you live in person is quite the experience. So how are you?
Well, I'm doing great. Thanks for the kind words. Wonderful to be with you.
So this question of crowding out with debt, I want to give you the broad strokes to just frame the conversation here for the sake of our listeners. They're not attending your lecture, but to understand this relationship between growth and economy, crowding out, and what debt does when handled rightly.
So I try to use the analogy of what we've learned in modern economic history with Japan to provide a sort of framework in the United States whereby many look at our debt issue and say, oh, there's going to be a future collapse.
Right.
There's going to be a future catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Some predict there's going to be massive inflation. I say all of those things are possible, but not the base case, mm-hmm. that in fact, while we're so busy looking for a future bang, we might be missing the whimper that's happening along the way,
yeah.
which is equally problematic. And that is the downward pressure it puts on economic growth. That even when there isn't a collapse moment, there is, since 2008, we have sort of accepted significantly subpar growth.
Yeah.
And that is now baked in to a declining opportunity set for mm-hmm. our children and grandchildren. And that this is all mathematical. It's not philosophical. It's not ideological. That there are so many more resources that have to be committed to paying the debt.
Yep.
That represented growth that had been pulled forward that now we don't get into the future.
Right.
And trying to understand this from an economic, but more importantly, from a moral standpoint.
And that's exactly what you do, which I greatly appreciate, the application of biblical principles into the work of governing our finances and economics, which, unfortunately, the secular economist just doesn't have a concept of.
Yeah.
Now, in light of that, as you mentioned earlier, the speculations of the average person about all this, could it be because of a lack of understanding of what an asset bubble is and what it does?
Well, there's definitely a lack of understanding about it. And part of the reason is that people like asset bubbles. Mm-hmm. They feel great when they're happening. And then, of course, the hangover that comes from it, people don't like, but they also tend to not fully understand what exactly happened. And then the point of this is that we don't really allow people to suffer the pain of it.
Uh-huh.
So we use fiscal policy, Keynesian government spending, and then monetary policy, artificially low interest rates, quantitative easing, various tools the Federal Reserve has. We use fiscal and monetary policy to sort of soften the effects of what has happened, and it creates a public misunderstanding of what happened and why and what it means going forward. It's understandable to some degree. Short-termism is kind of a way of life for a lot of people. But taking a longer-term perspective, I think it requires us to understand history a little bit.
Yeah.
And then looking forward, you know, we need to be grateful for what we have that makes us not Japan. You know, Japan had 0% economic growth for 30 years.
That's right.
We've had something just a little bit below 2% for over 15 years. That is much better than zero. It's also much less than the 3.1 real GDP growth that we had averaged from World War II all the way to the financial crisis.
Yep.
So we're somewhere in between there, where it's not as good as it could be, it's not as good as it should be, but it's better than it has been in countries like Japan. We owe that to the fact that we do have a stronger population, stronger productivity. There's a DNA of entrepreneurialism, of risk-taking in American life. But our demography is headed in the wrong direction.
Mm.
We're having less kids. Even when I talk about our DNA of risk-taking and entrepreneurialism, I see more and more demonization of risk-takers.
Exactly.
So class warfare is the enemy of productivity. I worry about those things going forward.
I want to ask you to speculate a little bit, and I also want to be considerate to the issue. But part of that baking into the DNA of a spirit of entrepreneurship, a stewarding of financial capital in a very particular way, the American mindset, the mm-hmm. mindset of Western civilization. In terms of the modern influx of immigrants, which respectfully, they bring a lot of value to the nation, but with regard to the baking of that DNA, that mindset, the working of the American perspective in economics, how much do you see that playing a part?
Well, it's interesting. I am one who for a long time would have been considered a little bit outside right-wing orthodoxy on immigration because though I favor strong border security, mm-hmm. I favor robust legal immigration mm-hmm. in an Ellis Island sense. But that presupposed my belief in assimilation to American ethos, to certain cultural distinctives, civic distinctives, including our regard not only for rule of law, but our regard for private property,
mm-hmm.
for social mobility, for risk-taking, for these types of things, mutual cooperation in society that I think is very advantageous. In other words, a kind of economic way of thinking. What I think is really poisoned the well on a lot of the way we talk now about immigration is that we assume immigration means an anti-assimilation.
Yes.
There's a kind of multiculturalism that does not call for people to embrace a lot of this. And in fact, it oftentimes encourages them to embrace the welfare state.
Right.
This complicates things a great deal. We need robust immigration as part of population growth. By the way, the less kids we're all having, the more we need it.
Yep.
Because economic growth, by definition, is population growth plus productivity growth. If population is not going to be growing from new fertility, then it's going to have to grow from immigration, or you're going to get downward pressure on economic growth.
That's right.
That's just an algebraic formula. Yep. I believe that what we need is both from our immigrant culture and our domestic-born culture, which involves our school system, our families, our communities, we need to celebrate an economic way of thinking.
Yep.
We need to celebrate the aspirational society.
Yeah.
So class warfare that demonizes successful people works against this. A heavy regulation and tax burden on small business, on family business, it hurts this way of thinking. So these things are all connected and ultimately part of the same conversation.
I completely agree, and that's why I asked you, because I know enough about what you do to know where your answer was going to go. And so that brings to mind that earlier point that you made about our, it's not just historical amnesia that we have right now, we seem to have an economic and financial amnesia.
Yeah.
And if we don't learn from history, taking a look at class warfare right now and the problems we have in even in terms of higher academia and how the free market system is just simply outrightly demonized. In the process of that, I want to ask you to comment on our borrowing habits of late especially and how that has impacted things like the price of capital and simply the debt bubble that we're seeing.
Well, it is a debt bubble that is very different than the 2008 debt bubble. We had a household debt bubble in 2008 that had to de-lever. Uh-huh. A lot of people had to liquidate assets at a loss,
yep.
basically give homes back.
Yep.
Then our financial system had to incur the losses of that, the debt holders,
yep.
the creditors who were left holding the bag. And what we've largely done since 2008 is de-lever households, more or less maintain leverage in the corporate sector, the non-financial business sector. That's where you can handle a fair amount of leverage because it's the most productive part of the economy. But then we've just substantially re-levered the governmental sector, which is the least productive part. There's no multiplier effect in levering up
yep.
The governmental sector. We are giving out a lot more money than we're taking in,
yeah.
and that deficit borrowing has led to a total credit card debt, if you will, that is many, many tens of trillions of dollars, and people are aghast that it could have ever gotten to this level.
Yeah.
I'm actually not as aghast at the level it got to as I am the fact that we're still adding to it at the pace we are, where the growth of the debt each year is running about 6% of GDP,
mm-hmm.
and the GDP growth is running somewhere between 2 and 3%.
Yep.
That we added a lot to the national debt in past decades, but never at a faster pace than the economy itself was growing.
Yep.
That's the issue that has really become a huge problem, and it's left a lot of people having to speculate as to the end game, because you could say, well, in a few more trillion dollars, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. But, of course, you know, we had a little less than $1 trillion of debt when Reagan left office. We
yeah.
have $37 trillion now. I don't think very many people would have thought we'd make it this far. I don't know where that level is. What I do know is that when you're in a ditch, sometimes the best thing to do is stop digging.
David, always a joy to connect with you. I'm looking forward to future conversations as we keep assessing where we are and how we're handling our debt situation. I've been talking with David Bahnsen, founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group, professor at Akron University 2025. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When I heard other business owners say they finally found someone in the credit card industry they can trust, I wondered how he could help me. So when Mark from Schisler CPC offered to show me where all the money goes for credit card processing with a free analysis of my business, I jumped on it. He reviewed how the industry works, where we could save, and offered a no-contract guarantee on savings and excellent customer service. I'm saving thousands of dollars a year. Schisler CPC. Trust in them.
More information available on the Ave Maria website under Sponsor Business Directory.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
One person doesn't like the Mona Lisa, the second person does. And the third person says, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's a popular saying, we know that. Remember, though, that beauty is an element of being. It describes what a thing is. And because it is an element of being, while we talk about beautiful paintings and buildings, we also talk about beautiful persons. We know that Grandma Kuzno is beautiful. We know that our children are beautiful. It even gives us joy to see the cleaning lady in the halls of school because she, too, carries a radiance of beauty. And if someone were to contradict you, if someone were to say, your consideration of Grandma Kuzno's beauty is just your own subjective opinion, we would know that person is wrong. Because beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. It is in my grandmother. It is in my child. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shield.
And trust is something that we're lacking these days. We don't have much trust in anyone, let alone the God we cannot see. And yet, if by grace and by the work of the Holy Spirit in us, by baptism and by confirmation, we ask the Lord just very simply, increase my faith. Increase my faith. God will give you eyes to see and ears to hear His action in your lives. You'll penetrate through the darkness, through the difficulty, and you'll begin to see. It's a walk by faith, but you'll begin to see, and God will give you confidence and strength to follow Him and to do it His way. It's not easy, but God will supply the faith if we ask for it. If I fix my gaze on Him now, I begin to experience more and more His action in our lives. You know, we've got to be attentive. God doesn't come in with a sledgehammer. He comes in with this small, still voice. We need to become sensitive and attentive. And if we ask the Holy Spirit, He will give it to us. Just keep asking.
Food for the Journey with Sister Ann Shields can be now heard on the audio archives page at AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, coming to you live, as you've been hearing some of these segments, from Acton University 2025. Really blessed to be part of this program every single year. Al Cresta, my predecessor and mentor, paved the way for us to continue these conversations with this wondrous program, this flagship conference, Acton University. Joining me to have a conversation about technology, religion, and the development of society and the common good is Dan Churchwell, Director of Programs in Education at the Acton Institute. Dan, thank you for making the time. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
The pleasure is completely ours, and I'm really grateful you made the time. And so your course this year has to do with technology, abundance, and the common good. And you clearly cover quite a range of topics within that one lecture. So painting with broad strokes here, one of the things that you've pointed out, which is completely true, there's this book, The Second Machine Age, where they talk about the exact same premise, that everywhere we've seen great technological booms, we have seen not only religious, but therefore socio-political upheavals or transformations, and this is globally ubiquitous. Yep. So that broad stroke, I just want to give you the floor.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, I love talking about technology. Obviously, everyone now, it seems to be talking about artificial intelligence. And you understand why. It's somewhat of a black box to some people, very exciting to some people. And so, but I've been excited and interested in the topic of technology for over 30 years and thinking and writing and speaking about it. And I really want people to see what Neil Postman argued is the ecological nature of technology. In other words, that it's not merely economics. Right. A lot of people talk about, you know, technology and the growth of abundance, or the idea of GDP growth or employment. But anywhere we have technology, you have technological disruption.
Yep.
And so when you think about disruption, and you know at Acton that we value the understanding of what it means to be human.
Yep.
And how do we interact with the tools that are around us, the people that are around us. And so technology is really at the intersection of that in most people's minds. And so just thinking well about technology is a really important thing, I think, for most people.
I'm really appreciative that you paved that part of the conversation, because if we begin there, we can also acknowledge that in the past 200 plus years, especially the past 225 years, we've really seen some massive growths in terms of technological advancement. So even if we go just as far back as the Industrial Revolution, and then after that, we look at the global diversification of labor that came about as a result of automation, and then we saw the digital revolution, and now we're seeing the machine learning revolution. I mean, never in history have we seen this much technological advancement in this short a span of historical time.
Yeah.
Tell us about what that has done in terms of the place of faith, religion, and reason in societies.
Yeah, in particular with the idea of religious conversations, you know, if you're theologically minded, it what it means to be human in a technological age. I mean, there's anthropological issues, there are issues of ecclesiology, like how do communities get together, churches, what does church look like, should that be online? You know, there's very practical conversations to have. Can you have full communion? And there's different denominations and religions have different views on that, so trying to parse what does it mean to be part of the body of Christ,
right?
And then there's a lot of people are worried about end times, possibly. And so eschatological, you know, eschatology, end times issues. Some people worry that we're going to usher in the apocalypse with
right.
certain, you know. And so that depending on who you're talking with, there's always a theological inroads
right.
or a philosophical inroads to have a conversation.
That's right.
And I think just asking good questions, to be very honest, you know, there's a spectrum between techno-optimism and techno-pessimism. And just trying to, you know, when you're with somebody, you're just trying to ask questions
to see
where they're at in that on that spectrum. I think is the really most important part. Getting to know somebody, what are their fears, what are their hopes? Because there's whole new religions being invented for example, Silicon Valley. There's several people that are trying to invent a religion that essentially makes artificial intelligence, or more specifically, artificial general intelligence, their God.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, it's just rich. You can't dissect what we understand sociologically, theologically about the human person and our religious upbringings and backgrounds and ideas from the technological age. Some people think there should be a hard rift, and it's just impossible.
Yep.
You can't dissect that. No matter who you talk to, they have some sort of existential or religious engagement with technology.
That's right. And so, this isn't a sidestep, but this is a parallel conversation because you brought up the notion of artificial general intelligence.
Right.
And so you've got these categorical distinctions that we are in the midst of developing. We've got machine learning, which will develop into a kind of full-fledged artificial general intelligence, and then ASI as well. So for the sake of our listeners, if you could help us understand what these spectrums of development look like and why it's crucial for us to be able to engage that well.
Sure. And from a journalistic perspective, when you're reading and writing and listening, almost everybody uses the term artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, but really, they wanted to use the term. In 1956, it was coined. So what a good friend of mine likes to say, you know, artificial intelligence is old enough to be collecting Social Security. It's an old idea, right?
In
technology, even though the last 3 years with ChatGPT and some of these other large language models. But when you say AI, you know you're talking to a journalist or somebody who's being hyper-generalistic, because there's 10 to 12 different types.
Right.
So asking the secondary questions are really important. Yeah. Are we talking about large language models?
Right.
Are we talking about machine learning? Are we talking about what it means to have AI agents?
Mm-hmm.
That's the new phrase of the year, it seems. You know, the agentic revolution, which means you can set these artificial intelligent bots going and they will do, like, I was watching a podcast recently, and the guy live on the podcast told his AI agent to order food for the group, and then they just and showed the process as they were talking about other things, and the agent just went and did all of it for him. It had access to his credit card, and then eventually the delivery guy came into the studio and gave them their food within 20 minutes after he just put one simple prompt in. I think the question for me is, how useful are we? What are we seeing the use cases for artificial intelligence now?
Uh-huh.
No matter what, once we ask those secondary questions, because if we're talking about large language models, the top three, it was just released last month, the top three uses of ChatGPT or its similar, you know, children, if you will, are all therapeutic.
Mm.
People are coming to ChatGPT, you know, you think about it, it should be coding or business related, and the top three are actually all therapeutic. They're coming to it for counsel, for therapy, for relationships, and this is self. I mean, this isn't one data point. This is so people are really, you know, when I think what technologists like to think is they have an idea of what they're building and its use.
Uh-huh.
And largely, when you study the history of technology, there are many different uses that come about that are well beyond the scope of what the designer thought it would be.
That's right.
And so I'm not a techno-skeptic necessarily, but I like to pull back on the hype a little bit and say, where is the hype? What are these doing? What is the data? Because a lot of it really is, if you want to be negative, a lot of it's propaganda or a lot of it's marketing.
Right.
Because a lot of these companies are trying to sell us something. Mm-hmm. And there's really not, outside of manufacturing and certain research ideas in science, there hasn't been a lot of technological development with AI that comes down to the common man using it from day to day in a financial way.
That's right.
Because when we go, we can use free. ChatGPT is free, essentially, to us, if you don't use one of the models that you pay for. And most people use it at that level. And so they're not seeing enterprise solutions that are really driving down to the common man. So I'm just, I just want to ask, have people, you know, temper the excitement, say, where can we use this tool? But as Marvin Kranzberg said, one of the fathers of the history of technology, he argues that technology, you know, they're tools, but tools, you know, neither positive nor negative, but they're never neutral.
Yeah.
Tools always change ecology.
Right.
And what I mean by ecology, I mean, you know, our social systems are, you know, I mean, there is, from a Catholic or a Protestant perspective, there are people building apps. There are people building, you know, can you go to confession with an app? Can, you know, there's really some interesting practical conversations to be had about the use cases of these tools.
I've been talking with Dan Churchwell, Director of Programs and Education at Acton Institute, continuing this conversation on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Welcome to an Advanced Dentistry Center family. This is Dr. Metti, and our team strives to treat you like family in a loving and compassionate way as we focus on serving you in a Christ-like manner. We do this by emphasizing prevention and general well-being for a lifetime. Our private practice is small, personal, state-of-the-art, and innovative, with the goal to educate and motivate our patients in improving their oral health. It is through a partnership with you that you will achieve the goals for your smile. Advanced Dentistry is serious about the level of care we provide, with attention to details and an exceptional level of care, skill, and judgment. We are thrilled for the opportunity to serve you.
Dr. Matthew and the team invite you to visit them at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com or call them at 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. AdvancedDentistryCenter.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
How can the Catholic Church claim to be missionary and apostolic? The Catholic Catechism teaches us that the Church's missionary task continues through the worldwide evangelization and dialogue with non-believers. Believers can benefit from this dialogue through encounters with elements of truth and grace which represent the secret presence of God. The Catechism asserts that the Church is apostolic because she was built on the foundation of the apostles, the witnesses Christ himself chose and sent on mission. With the assistance of the Holy Spirit, the Church keeps and hands on the teaching of the apostles, and she continues to be taught, sanctified, and guided by the apostles through their successors, the College of Bishops, assisted by priests, in union with the Pope, until Jesus returns. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Fieser, coming to you live from Acton University 2025, a real blessing to be here. And I'm joined by Dan Churchwell, Director of Programs and Education at Acton Institute. And Dan, when we left off, you were talking about how tools, including artificial intelligence, just as a kind of generalized term, by themselves, they are morally neutral, but in their execution, they're not actually neutral. There's always going to be a kind of ecological impact mm-hmm. that drives the society one way or the other, and we're seeing this. We're seeing this not just in terms of the rapid-fire reality of access to information and even reasoning mm-hmm. to some degree. We're also seeing it transform the academic landscape, transform the general writing landscape. So I want to springboard from there in terms of talking about human flourishing and the common good and how technology helps or harms that.
No, that's good. My talk this year is actually, you know, I've spoken on artificial intelligence the last 5 years, and so I shifted a little bit this year, and I wanted to talk about, because in my reading I'm beginning to see people are overemphasizing artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's going to be a game changer. Yes, there's going to be, you know, use case. I believe it's real, but I think we neglect certain kinds of things in our normal lives. Some people, when they buy real estate, they come against something called deferred maintenance mm. when they buy a building. You know, and a lot of times somebody, if they've held a building for a while and they buy it, they have to refurbish it. New uh-huh. paint, new maybe some new pipes, you know, new sheetrock. And it's the same thing with technology all around us. And I think we overemphasize the flashy thing, the new thing, the artificial intelligence conversation, to the neglect of things that are much more mundane but more important to human flourishing. And what I mean by that, for the common good, is the grid system, our infrastructure, our roads, our sewers, things we take for granted. But if didn't exist or aren't maintained, they will deleteriously affect all of the other systems. You could never have artificial intelligence if you don't have proper electrical grids. And when you look at the developing world, the number one thing they need now are solid infrastructures to build flourishing societies.
Right.
So if we're really concerned about development or concerned about human flourishing in the vast majority of the world, they don't need artificial intelligence at the moment.
Yep.
They need solid infrastructure. And my lecture will go through and talk about some of the areas of neglect and issues that come when you, and if we were to double down on those issues, the common good would be served actually better than hyper-emphasizing digital technologies, but artificial intelligence specifically. And I think, but it's, since it's more mundane,
uh-huh.
it's more, you know, we don't talk about it a lot. But maintenance, who likes to talk about maintenance? Who likes to talk about mowing the yard or uh-huh. clipping their flowers back, you know, and just the general maintenance of making things beautiful? That is arguably more important.
Yeah.
That keep, and so I want, it's like a tempering effect. I'm trying to temper. Yes, it's good and fun to talk about these things like artificial intelligence and digital technology, but I also believe we're losing some of the more ordinary understanding and connection to modern life through technologies that we just take for granted.
Right. And going back to a mutual friend or a mutual favorite author that you brought up, Neil Postman, mm-hmm. In Amusing Ourselves to Death, he brought up that reality that as soon as we went visual,
with our media, with our proliferation of information, we substituted the capacity for long-form and long-term thinking out of ideas for short-term and entertainment bursts.
Right.
And we're seeing that with this whole AI thing. It's easier to proliferate the rapid-fire burst message that we're in an apocalyptic era. Mm-hmm. Eras, and, you know, Terminator, right? Skynet's going to take over the world.
Yes.
Rather than those mundane, daily, ordinary, transient things that have long-term repercussions about the continued building of structures for the sake of human flourishing.
And I'm going to generalize the quote, but C.S. Lewis, the Christian philosopher and apologist at Oxford, he had a way of saying, and I'm going to generalize the quote, the idea of, you know, we're in an age, he was writing in the age of the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And he said, if an atomic bomb were to be dropped, what I want to remind all of you is that I hope we're going about the ordinary things of life. Mm. I hope we're marrying and engaging and working and things and being communal and staying in our communities. Those are what matter. Right. Sometimes the bigger things we can't. It affects us in ways that we can't adjust our lives around. So we should be living our ordinary, good lives.
Right.
And I think that builds a more cultural understanding around technology, not merely an economic understanding of technology.
Right. And in fact, that's precisely why this language of virtue and human flourishing is so crucial to have. We need to be able to sit down with ideas.
Yes.
The problem is, as you've rightly noted, is that atomic bombs make the news. Artificial intelligence doing something odd makes the news. Mm-hmm. Dad mowing lawn doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Husband and wife providing for the family doesn't.
Right.
And yet those are the things that uphold those structures and frameworks necessary for continued societal flourishing.
There's a quote that P.J. O'Rourke says that he goes, everybody wants to change the world, but nobody wants to help mom with the dishes.
Right.
And that's it really is a drive. The more I study these topics, that for some reason, that undercurrent still, I'm so passionate now, moving into probably the last third of my career, is talking about what makes the ordinary, mundane life good.
Yep.
Because a lot of people are looking beyond what's right in front of them. Marriage, children, good work, virtuous life, communal, church engagement. Yeah. These kinds of things are important.
Yeah.
And if we get too caught up in some of the hype around digital technologies, I believe we miss the richness of the everyday.
Right. And let's face it, we've been sold a sensationalist bill of goods.
For sure.
It's what sells the product.
Mm-hmm.
And as we continue to be fed that narrative, it's easy to become techno-skeptic. In fact, it's easy to become techno-apocalyptic.
For sure.
And so from there, we create this overtly anxious generation to, you know, borrow from another book.
Right.
And when we start thinking in those terms, we stop thinking about those things that, like you say, define what it means to live the good life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think more of our parishes, more of our churches, more of our families need to center around these ideas.
Yeah.
That's why I use the phrase the common good.
Yep.
The more we have the ordinary things in our lives centered, the better we will be at thinking about some. I mean, the big ideas matter.
Yep.
Right? There are philosophical and theological truths to be engaged here. I'm not saying those aren't important, but I believe those come out of more ordinary times in our lives.
Right. And so this question of abundance, this question of, like you mentioned, the common good, it's not something that happens by happenstance. It happens by virtue engaging with human capacity, engaging with these laws of the free market, the laws of natural reason at play. And because it's a common good, you're seeing how the human person functions within society to bring about its flourishing. Every one of us serves that purpose. So for the sake of our listeners, even in utilizing digital technology, an exhortation about how we ought to go about this well.
For sure. I mean, we all use it to some degree, right? I mean, you don't meet many people that are completely off-grid.
Mm-hmm.
Or those that are off-grid are advertising it on YouTube. You know, it's a funny conundrum. But this idea that technology is a gift and using it well is something we should hold at high value and not. I think when we wake up in the morning, we flush a toilet, we turn a shower on, we flick a light switch, we just forget all of the work that has gone in to give us the lives we have.
Right.
And there's a certain sense of centering about being thankful for the technology that is more mundane,
yeah,
and realizing, okay, how do I use this for the glory of God?
Right.
How do I use this to the community, the benefit of my community?
Right.
And so it's not pure profit motive. When you hear some of the technologists, it seems like they're out to make the next large thing, become the next billionaire. And as we know, in free markets, profit follows, and I love that. But it's servicing a customer.
Yep.
And so what are we building, and who will be using it, and how it will be shaping them, I think are just as important conversations as not as just the bottom line.
Right. And so the question is, see a need, fill a need. That's how
absolutely free, it's so basic. Work. Yeah, right.
So we're running out of time, and I want to have you frame the conversation as how we started, which has to do with Catholics listening right now, Christians listening right now, have an obligation to engage all of these spheres, not in trepidation, not in isolationism, but in the reality that Christ truly is Lord over every sphere of human ingenuity,
absolutely,
including the development of technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and those, I mean, some of your listeners might be involved in the discipline of creating code, of creating these, you know, and those are worthy labors. But having, again, like I said earlier, the secondary questions, not merely how much money can we get for our product, which is, again, a fine motivation. It shouldn't be the sole motivation. So thinking about when we use technology, what is it for, and how is it helping or hindering? Paul Virilio, the Italian philosopher, said it this way: when you invent the ship, you invent the shipwreck. When you invent the plane, you invent the plane crash. When you invent electricity, you invent electrocution.
Right.
The negativity of any technology is invented therein.
Right.
In other words, there are always trade-offs. That's a lot of words to say there are always positives and negatives. So being sober-minded, looking at the society around us and being sober-minded, how do I use this? How does it shape me? And therefore, how do I need to adjust my family life, my personal life, and my business life around that idea of virtue?
Right. And virtue is the key here, even at a natural level. I've been talking with Dan Churchwell. He's Director of Programs and Education at Acton Institute. And his course this year has to do with technology, abundance, and the common good. He talks about how technology and innovation are commonly linked with material and social prosperity. He has a piece out on religion and liberty called The Gospel According to Silicon Valley, wherein he talks about how technology, especially over the past 225 years, has really created a milieu of shaping religious and socio-political development in culture. So check out his work and consider coming to Acton University 2026. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.